Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We begin our program today by talking with Janet Redman, who's director of climate policy program for the Institute for Policy Studies in Paris for the climate policy talks, and joins us now. Janet, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you can call in with your comments at 410-319-8888. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner, comment on our Facebook pages, or send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. But 410-319-8888. So there's a lot to cover in the few minutes we have together today, and look forward to a long conversation next week as things settle in there in Paris. But, you know, I was reading an article I sent you earlier from the London Telegraph about people who are major skeptics of all this, and it becomes... When that comes out, it becomes major pieces of our news that people take very seriously, which is that things like the Earth is actually we're at a halt in terms of what they call the pause for global rise and warming, that the oceans and the currents and solar flares are more dominant factors in this than anything we do with fossil fuels, that the islands like the Maldives are not losing land to sea rise, but that becomes part of the common wisdom. So, how does that fit into all this?
Well, I think it's a real problem. I mean, obviously, a lot of the article you sent me was basically ten things about global warming that aren't really true in the science. And
right.
For each of those pieces of those ten, you know, there's an entire body of evidence that disproves that their points. So, you know, I just think of my friends who actually are here from the Maldives, from Kiribati, from Tuvalu, who are you know, really pouring out their hearts inside the climate negotiations to world leaders, saying we have a tide every single day that carries away part of our land, or every time there's a storm we get inundated, or I can't drink the water anymore on my island because salt water has intruded into our groundwater, into our drinking water. So you know, it's not only misleading, it's actually quite offensive to many of the people who are at the receiving end of climate change. So I think it really is a shame that this kind of sensationalized news story gets as much pickup as it does. And I think it's challenging, of course, because those of us who care about climate change have not done a particularly good job of translating the science in a way that's accessible for people. And when things are big and scary and complex, I understand why it's a whole lot easier just to put your head in the sand. But unfortunately, the longer we put in our head in the sand, the longer our leaders put their heads in the sand, the worse the problem's going to get, and the harder it's going to be to actually fight it in the long run.
Earlier this morning, I saw the Oxfam report that came out, Extreme Carbon Inequality, and I read through it as much as I could before the program, but haven't been able to get into it in depth. So let me just read a piece of this to you and see how this fits into what is happening in the climate talks. One of the things it wrote in its summary was that about 3.5 billion people are responsible for only 10% of global emissions attributed to individual consumption, yet overwhelmingly in countries most vulnerable to climate change. Around half of all the emissions, meanwhile, can be attributed to the richest 10% of the people of the world, whose average carbon footprints are 11 times as high as the poorest half of the globe, 60 times as high as the poorest 10%. The average footprint of the richest 1% globally could be 175 times that of the poorest 10%. Now, how does that fit into a line that comes from a New York Times article today or the other day that wrote that over the next 2 weeks, the idea to cut emissions will inevitably fall short of what's needed to solve the problem of climate change? So there's a contradiction here.
Absolutely. I mean, this contradiction is the crux of the climate negotiations. In fact, inequality is the crux of the climate negotiations here in Paris. What's happening, of course, is yes, the climate crisis is born out of inequality. Those folks who the countries of the global north are incredibly, overwhelmingly responsible for the climate crisis today. But what some of our governments are trying to do is turn that on its head. It's a little bit of like a narrative jujitsu. In their rhetoric, they're saying, hey, wait a minute, China is now the biggest emitter as a country. What they're not saying is within China, the population that's under the poverty level is huge. Or, you know, right now India is being called up as the bad guy, as the scapegoat. But 300 million people in India are living under a dollar a day. So while, you know, India is the third largest emitter of greenhouse gases overall, that doesn't look at the footprint, the carbon footprint of everyone living in India. In the U.S., our carbon footprint is something like 20 tons of carbon per day. That's that's incredibly higher than the 1.5 tons of carbon that the average person in India is making. The implications are really important because, again, what we're seeing in the United States right now is a recalcitrant Congress that's saying we will not send any climate support to countries like India. We will not even send climate support to countries like Tuvalu that are going underwater, because why should we write a blank check to those countries? And the answer is, actually, because we've been at the heart of causing this problem. We have a moral obligation to send support, and we actually have a legal obligation. We signed up to the convention in 1992. So this idea of equity and inequality really comes back to our pocketbooks in a large way.
So that's hard for people in this country to swallow.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying? I mean,
I understand that.
When we think of moral obligations, because we were at the root of this. So what does that mean, we are at the root of this?
I mean, it's what you just mentioned before. We are historically on the hook. The United States, for example, is historically on the hook for about 25% of the emissions that are in the atmosphere now that are causing this global warming. So maybe even if we want to move away from the moral call, if we want to move away from the kind of the human rights imperative of doing our fair share, both in cutting our emissions, climate pollution in the U.S., and also delivering climate support in terms of financing, we could actually just look at the impacts of climate change overall. We in the United States, whether we're rich or poor, will of course feel the impacts of a warmer world. It's going to mean disruption from extreme weather. We've seen that already in Katrina. We've seen that in New York, New Jersey, and Hurricane Sandy. It will mean that food prices go up in our country as supply chains are disrupted. It means the price of goods will go up. It means we'll see increased migration from all over the world. We'll see increased migration from within our own country as we need to move off the coast, but we'll see migration from other parts of the world. Because climate change is unfortunately going to exacerbate the kinds of instability and conflict that are already happening around the world. So it hits us both because we are impacted by climate change in the U.S., but it also hits us because, of course, everyone on the planet is impacted by climate change, and then that has reverberations and ripples that move through both our economy and society.
So we're making a lot the press is making a great deal of Bill Gates and others, mm-hmm. who are coming into it with this intensive focus on energy innovation.
And
there's always kind of this kind of love-hate relationship with wealth and power that people have.
Fair enough.
So how do their proposals, what do their proposals mean, and how does that really fit into this larger question of facing the reality of what the next 50 years might mean?
Yeah, it's a really interesting. We were all really excited to hear about this Breakthrough Energy Coalition, and Bill Gates is at the lead, but it's a number of different business and investment, finance leaders from the U.S. and other countries, and they're talking about providing billions of dollars for exciting new energy innovations, clean energy innovations. And that's important. And of course, the private sector is going to have a role to play. Business is going to have a role to play in addressing climate change. We know that, both because that's where money is. That's part of what's driving new ideas, interesting ideas. I think the risks that many of us are concerned about, who are looking at this, the whole spectrum of the kinds of action that countries should do, is that it, in some ways, it takes the attention off of the public sector. It takes the attention away from the actor that actually we have some control over, and that's our democratically elected government. It's up for debate how much control we have.
I was about to say.
We can't even assert power on Bill Gates, except we can say, we don't want to buy any more of your products, but we can't actually, we can't say, oh, we dethrone you as a billionaire, unless we do, of course, do some really interesting tax policies and redistribute the wealth that's in his pocket. But that's another issue. So I think the important thing is, of course, we need everyone to be involved in fighting climate change. Naomi Klein says it takes everyone to change everything, but that doesn't mean we have to supplant public institutions, public money, public pressure for private sector innovation. That private sector innovation needs to be married with the public sector, both in the global north, both in our country, where that money is coming from. But most importantly, there has to be a way to make sure that whatever this breakthrough initiative, this breakthrough coalition comes up with, is actually meeting the needs of the people who are most impacted by both climate change and by energy poverty.
So well, the two people here, I'm interested in their ideas that popped up in some articles I've been reading. One is Mark Jacobson, who's an engineer at Stanford University. And he claims that we could the entire world could operate 100% renewable energy by 2050 by building 156,000 wind turbines off the U.S. coast, let's say, for example, in the next 35 years. I mean, and we've not even come close to doing any of that. So, I mean, again, between what's happening outside and inside, mm-hmm. how serious are these kind of conversations?
I mean, the conversations in both spaces are incredibly serious. The conversation outside, the kind of research that Mark Jacobson is doing, talking about getting to 100% renewable energy by 2050, is incredibly serious. In fact, that's the call in large part that's been taken up by much of civil society, particularly those who are really focused on a fast energy transition and a fast economic transition. Inside, they're being taken seriously as well. Unfortunately, inside the negotiations, the way of dealing with them is by blocking some of these important attempts. So, for example, we're seeing inside the negotiations that many of the developing countries are calling on the U.S. and developed countries, calling on everyone to sign a legally binding treaty that has legally enforceable commitments to reducing greenhouse gas emissions and commitments to providing the financial support that they're bound to and under the convention. But we see countries like the U.S. saying, no, we actually don't want to be bound. We don't want anyone telling us what kind of no one should be setting for each of us what we should do, but each of us should be setting those commitments by ourselves. So, unfortunately, the way that governments are acting inside the Paris Climate Summit is to back away from any kind of commitments that leave them on the hook for actually delivering greenhouse gas mitigation, for actually producing the finance that would make 100% renewable energy possible. But I think I want to harp on that point for a second, this 100% renewable energy piece, because I think what's really important is not just the what. So when I think about a transition and responsible energy sector, for example, there's the type of energy, renewable versus dirty. Absolutely, we should be talking about renewable energy. We have to dig a little bit deeper and understand that we have to make sure that renewable energy, that we're not talking about nuclear power, that we're not talking about burning trash, which is incredibly toxic and is actually very carbon and energy intensive. We're not talking about quote unquote clean energy, where you burn coal and then you try to bury the emissions in rock form, geological formations underground. So we've got to be really careful about the type. We've also got to be careful about the scale. So massive wind farms across Mexico right now are actually threatening the livelihoods of small farmers because they're not allowed into that area anymore. So when we need to be careful about the scale. What's really important for a true transition is decentralized, community scale, even household scale solar, wind, hydro systems. And then, of course, there's a third leg, which is the ownership model. So does it make sense for us to transition to an economy where BP runs the solar field, where BP runs the wind farm? I think we need to be really cautious about that. We're already hearing from workers today, wait a minute, green jobs aren't necessarily union jobs. Green jobs may not be safe jobs. They may not be well-paying jobs. We've got a moment right now where the world's actually looking at climate change and looking at inequality. What an exciting time to marry those two pieces together and say, whatever the clean energy revolution is, whatever the zero waste revolution is, we've got to make sure that actually addresses the needs of workers and communities as well as putting real clean energy in place.
So, Jen, I'm curious how you – if you perceive that what you're describing is being discussed inside those halls, or is it just being discussed by people in the civil world?
I think in some ways it's being talked about inside. I mean, there is a strong coalition of countries called the Climate Vulnerable Forum. It's 20 countries from the global south. Many of them are least developed countries, which means lowest income countries, small island developing states, countries on the African continent, the countries that will be most, that already are being most impacted by climate change and are most impacted by an economic system that's really focused on extracting resources from some of those poor countries. So that group has said very clearly, we want 100% renewable energy by 2050. We want a decarbonized economy. The U.S. has said, maybe by the end of the century, countries like India have said, we don't want to talk about decarbonization yet because we're still trying to meet our basic energy needs. So absolutely, it's part of the conversation inside. Unfortunately, it's not on the lips of some of the most powerful geopolitical players on the inside of the talks.
I mean, some of the things where the assumptions about pushing this stuff, pushing these ideas, are, I think, are critically important, but they do take on, in many ways, questioning the entire basis of our economic system. I mean, if we're
that's right. I think the reality is climate change pulls into question the entire basis of our economic system, both having to answer the question, gosh, where does climate change come from? Well, it comes from an economic system that says we can expand infinitely.
Right.
Unfortunately, that butts up against the fact that we have a finite planet and we have an atmosphere that can only absorb a finite amount of carbon dioxide. But same with the solution. So yes, you're right. I think one of the things that's very important is that we're caught in a funny mentality, particularly inside, where global leaders who are in large part responsible to their citizens and voters, but are also very responsible in an uncomfortable way to the other most powerful force on the planet, which I think is corporate power, who are in large part paying the checks of their campaigns. They want answers too, and unfortunately they want answers that will keep that business model running.
So I'm curious, just for our listeners, so you're there in Paris at the climate talks, but talk about what's going on in the world you're in out there. What are you doing there? I don't mean that in a pejorative way. What are you doing there?
I mean, it's really interesting. We're in two different spaces there. I mean, there are multiple sets of conversations going on, as you mentioned. There are the talks that are happening between leaders. There are the talks that are happening with negotiating teams of governments, and oftentimes we're trying to get meetings with those leaders and those negotiators to say, hey, you need to put these provisions on the table as well. And in fact, we've got a large constituency that's advocating for this. We're trying to support some of the government teams who have fewer staff than others. For example, the U.S. comes with an incredibly huge team. Other countries come with a small team. And if they decide to sleep one night, that means they may not get to comment on a working group that other people can work through the night. But there are also conversations happening, of course, outside the official negotiating halls. And those are really interesting as well. I mean, there are tens of thousands of people here that are not going into the climate talks, in part because the UN has actually incredibly restricted our access to those talks, but in part because some of the most interesting conversations are happening outside, because that's actually where people from communities all over the world are getting together to say, hey, our governments aren't acting either. So what are you putting in place? And folks from California, for example, are here saying, well, we're working on rooftop solar. And folks in Germany are saying, hey, so are we. How do we work on this together? What kind of tax policies have you put in place at the municipal, state, and federal level? So it's an incredibly dynamic space. So I spend a lot of my time in both spaces, actually trying to balance those two. I really think of my role as translating some of those outside demands into policy language, and vice versa, taking the policy conversation and translating that into you know, normal human language that people can understand and can react to in a way that puts pressure back on our leaders.
So I'm curious about a couple of things before we go. Is how has the French government's lockdown affected what's happening to the tens of thousands outside?
Yeah, it's a good question. Right off the bat, while we were all arriving before last weekend, 24 people were actually put under house arrest who were planning some of the demonstrations here, both the march that was going to happen on the 29th, but also folks that are planning actions around Paris, focusing on some of the worst corporate actors that are responsible for the climate crisis and at the same time sponsoring the climate summit. So there's a real irony there. I think what was really exciting for me was that French civil society said, we want to still march. And in fact, we want our international allies to come in solidarity and be with us in the streets. We're not going to allow folks, you know, terrorism to stop us from living our life. And we're not going to allow government repression to stop us from living our lives either. So please come into the streets, be with us. And so 10,000 people who are in Paris, you know, went along the route of the march, held hands, held the banners that people had prepared for the march, everything from, you know, respect indigenous rights to ecofeminists for climate justice to keep the fossil fuels in the ground. People were holding up those banners along the march route, holding hands, being stationary instead of marching. But I think it was an incredible show to the French government that says, we're not going to be silenced. We're not going to stop having our voices heard. We're not going to stop letting people know that we're here. We're not going to stop letting the leaders know that there's pressure from the outside and from citizens here and when they go home again.
I'm fascinated by how this is panning out, and we're looking forward to the next week to having you back on, and maybe with some others as well from Paris, to kind of get under this in a deeper way for a longer conversation. I appreciate the work you do, Janet, and also taking your time with us here.
Thank you so much.
And I thank you so much. I look forward to continuing our conversations. Janet Redmond is Director of the Climate Policy Program for the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and for the next week and a half, we'll be in Paris at these climate talks, walking inside the building and working and outside with the activists who came from around the world to address these issues that are part of all of our futures if we're going to survive. Janet Redmond, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And we're going to take a very brief break. And then we come back, we're going to look at media and race and what happens in our country, how things are portrayed and why they're portrayed that way, and what they do for the national consciousness. We want to hear your thoughts about that. So stay with us. We'll be right back.